irk. I know how incredibly shitty academia has always been to me, a woman in physics. And I just did the same to another woman in physics. A woman in physics whom I've admired for years. What the hell did I just do? Who the fuck is this person inside me? I'm so sorry. My hand flies to my mouth to muffle a sob. I'm so, so sorry. It's not even true. None of it. I've read her articles. She's amazing, and it's okay. Jack's expression is back to soft, like I'm not the protocluster of all assholes. No, I shake my head. No, she doesn't deserve any of it, and fuck, fuck. My throat burns with guilt and something that feels a lot like shame. My cheeks are icy and wet, very wet. I press the heels of my palms into my eyes, but the tears keep coming.
Elsie, it's okay. You have every right to be upset.
No, it's not okay. I'm being unreasonable, and none of this is Georgina's fault. And as terrible as you are, it's not your fault either. I'm the one who fucked up the interview and— Another sob. He heard this time. No way he didn't. You shouldn't let me talk to you like this. He is silent for a moment. Then I feel him take a step closer. He doesn't touch me, but his coat brushes against mine, a muted swishing sound.
I like it, actually.
I look up. There's a faint smile on his lips.
You like being yelled at?
I like to see you. When you're not trying to be someone else.
I'm actually hiccuping, like a 3-year-old with a bruised elbow at the monkey bars. I bite the inside of my cheek to make it stop, but it's a lost battle. Like my entire stupid life. I can't imagine why.
I like rare occurrences.
I need to leave. I can't stand here, shivering, being snowed on in the middle of the sidewalk, with Jonathan Smith Turner bawling like I'm on an onion farm, but crying my heart out and thoroughly humiliating myself in front of a professional rival takes up all my energy, which means I can't leave.
It's cold,
he says, like he's reading my mind.
I live 5 minutes from here.
I sniffle, unsure how to answer.
Bully for you?
But then he adds,
come over.
I must have shown some kind of reaction because he continues.
Not for anything you're thinking. Come over so I can warm you up. I want to explain what happened with the search.
No, I'm not. No.
I'll answer your questions. Tell you exactly what happened.
I can't. His hand comes up to cup the back of my head, like he wants to make sure that our eyes are locked for this, that we understand each other.
Elsie, if I let you go right now, you're just going to replay the whole interview in your head and reach the misguided conclusion that it's your fault you didn't get the job, and you're never going to let me talk to you again.
His expression is painfully honest. How does he know all this stuff about me? I don't even know it.
Maybe I'll just blame it on you,
I sniffle. He huffs out a laugh.
There she is.
I'm sorry. I know you want to help, but I can't talk now. I'm crying.
That's fine.
No, it's not fine, because I almost never cry.
A sob.
Which means that I have no idea how to stop.
Then you can cry forever.
No, I don't want to cry. And I left Cece behind. And I need to tell Dr. L that I didn't get the job. And you need to let Georgina know where you are. And I'm fucking freezing. I hate this city. And I hate being a physicist. And I hate Volkov's stupid puns. And
his arms are wool and iron around me. Perfectly warm, perfectly solid. It's several more moments of crying before I realize that he has pulled me against him. That this is a hug. His lips, dry and warm, press against my forehead, as though he cares, as though all he wants is to comfort me. Low murmurs warm my frozen skin, soft sounds that I cannot immediately decipher.
Shh, it's okay, Elsie. It's going to be fine.
I want to believe him. I want to sink into him more than I've ever wanted anything else. I want to bury my face in his black coat and make it my own personal wormhole. Instead, I keep crying huge, silent tears, curl my fingers into the fabric of his sleeve, and hold on tight. This is the worst, my lowest yet. And not only is Jack Smith Turner witnessing it, I also don't have it in me to mind too much. So when he says, "Let me get you warm, let me do this one thing for you," and his hand slides down to take mine, I allow him to guide me wherever he wants. 14. Center of Momentum Frame. His condo is large, especially for downtown. Two-story, 90% windows. Open floor, E. There might even be a color scheme, dark blues and warm whites, but I can't picture Jack using the word palette, so I chalk it up to chance. Still, the place is clean and uncluttered enough that I automatically take off my shoes at the entrance, then pad my way after him to the open plan kitchen, hoping Jack won't notice that my socks match in pattern, stripes, but not color, pink and orange. I wish there were hints that he's a closeted brony or an avid collector of genital casts, but this place screams, "I might be an unmarried man in his 30s, but it's not because I don't have my shit together." Then again, he might be unmarried, but he's not quite single. I sit gingerly at the wooden dining table and eye a bowl of fresh fruit. Books and printouts of journal articles stacked neatly on the breakfast island. Jack's large back, his muscles bunching under green flannel as he putters around the stove, quickly types something on his phone and sets a mug on the counter. The snow is picking up, giant flakes swirling under the streetlight, and getting home is going to be a bitch. I could splurge on an Uber. Shouldn't, though. This is weird. So weird. I should be too devastated to feel awkward, but like I said, I'm an excellent multitasker. Able to experience the existential dread seeping into my unemployed bones and to fantasize about crawling into a golf hole out of sheer embarrassment. Even worse, I'm so damn cold. I wrap my hands in the tear-sticky sleeves of my cardigan, slide them between my thighs, and close my eyes. I take a slow, deep breath. Another. Another. Seconds or minutes later, porcelain clinks against the wood. I blink up, and Jack's forearm is there, with its roped muscles and the light hairs and that cut of tattoo peeking from under the rolled-up sleeve. I've seen him half naked, and I still don't know what it's supposed to be. "Hot chocolate," he says gently, as though I'm a skittish kitten. It smells delicious, of sugar and comfort and heat. I watch a handful of marshmallows float happily around the top, and my mouth waters. "Do you know?" I start, then shake my head and fall silent. Food can be such an ordeal when your pancreatic cells have left the chat. I remember my last year of middle school at Chloe Sampson's birthday party, the most amazing sheet cake with buttercream frosting. Before eating a slice, the diabetes havers, i.e. me, needed to know exactly what was in it to counteract it with the appropriate dose of insulin. But who knows what's in a slice of Costco cake? Not me, and not Mrs. Sampson, and not the Costco website or the customer service hotline, which Mrs. Sampson called while 15 starving teenage girls glared at me for holding up the party. And Well, the point is, I've learned to say no to unexpected sugar, no matter how tasty looking. People don't like nuisances. Thank you, but I'm not thirsty.
You need the carb count?
Jack sets the package with the nutritional info beside it.
To adjust your bolus?
I tilt my head. Did you just use the word bolus?
Sure did.
He takes a seat right across from me. Even the chairs in his house look too small for him. How?
I went to school. I know words.
He seems amused. You went to school for words like centripetal and brittleness and Russland optical depth. The only people who know stuff about basal insulin and bolus are doctors.
How fortunate, then.
Medical doctors. And people with diabetes. He stares for a moment, then says,
I'm sure others do, too. Families of people with diabetes. Friends. Partners.
His voice is deep and rich, and I need to look away from the way he's studying me. So I take out my phone and quickly check my insulin, pretending I can't feel his eyes on me. I lift my t-shirt to make sure that the pod didn't get dislodged in the single act of exercise I engaged in during the last decade, and honestly, I can't remember the last time I did this in front of someone who isn't Cece. I want to ask Jack if he read up on diabetes after finding out about mine, but it's possibly the most self-centered thought I've ever had. I have about 40 new notifications across 5 apps, all from Cece. Cece, where are you? We're going to the Starbucks across from the theater to wait for you guys to come back. Please let me know you're okay. I know this sucks, but I'm with you. We can do this. We'll move into a basement. I'll pick up more faux dates. You'll be my sugar baby. Jack texted George and told her you're okay. She seems to think he's trustworthy, but IDK. He looks like an oak tree on steroids with a 6'8" wingspan. Is he even human? Elsie? Question mark. Worried face emoji. I answer with a quick, I'm fine. With Jack. Go home, please. When I look up, Jack is staring. I clear my throat. Bad faith interview. What does it mean? His expression darkens.
That would be any interview in which the outcome is, for whatever reason, pre-decided. Like positions that are advertised as open when they're meant for a specific candidate.
The MIT position was created for Georgina? I feel a pang in my chest.
More complicated than that. The position was originally left vacant when James Bickart, an experimentalist, retired 2 years ago. He was, I believe, 3 million years old.
I chuckle despite myself. Sounds about right.
You know the type. Lots of tweed, lots of distrust toward computers, lots of opinions on girls who wear nail polish despite the distraction of their male peers. I was still at Caltech, but I heard some stories. The position should have been refilled immediately, but there were issues with the budget. Then, my grants and I moved here.
He pushes the forgotten mug closer. I'm impatient to hear more, but I take a sip to please him. The warmth spreading into my stomach is delicious.
I offered to help fund the position to hire another experimentalist, not out of some deep hatred for theorists, if you can believe it. I was hired by MIT to beef up their experimental output. Experimentalists are currently outnumbered, and we were filling a specific position. I mentioned the opening to George, and she told me she was interested in applying. She's at Harvard right now, and physics academia is an old boys' club everywhere. But Harvard's bad. So she sent in her materials, and you said you're familiar with her work. As you can imagine, everyone knew it was going to be her from the start.
I can imagine it very well. Her thesis experiments were stepping stones to massive advancements in particle physics. Georgina is the epitome of inspiring.
And you applied. And Monica was so impressed by your CV, she decided to bring you in despite the committee recommending against it. It was pointed out to her that there was nothing you could have done during the interview that would have gotten you the job, but she insisted, reasoning that George already had an excellent position at Harvard and might decide not to accept an offer. He sighs. Even if George weren't a rock star, you have to understand, she and I were in grad school together. We've had half a decade longer than you in the field. Half a decade worth of scientific output, publications, grants. You're the ideal candidate, Monica told me the first night we met. But I wasn't. I simply wasn't. Why did Monica? She tried her all to hire a theorist. And I have to admit, she played her cards well by choosing you as her candidate. He leans forward. I drag my eyes up to his. Elsie, I was there for the final vote. George won because she was best qualified, but everyone in the department was impressed with you. Which doesn't surprise me after I saw your talk and read your articles.
Right. I press my fingers into my eyes. My articles.
They're excellent. And also,
I look at him. Also? He wets his lips like he needs time to phrase something.
Sometimes when I read them, I can almost hear them in your voice. Your personality.
He shakes his head, self-effacing, like he knows he's being fanciful.
The turn of sentence here, a formula there.
I thought we'd agreed that I don't have a personality. I'm tempted to say. But I'm too tired to be bitter. And Jack, he's been nothing but kind. I try for a smile. I can't blame you for voting for her.
I didn't.
My eyes widen.
I recused myself.
Why? He opens his mouth, but the words don't come immediately.
I had a conflict of interest.
Because of George. He smiles faintly.
Because of you, Elsie.
I have no idea how to interpret this, so I just don't. Aren't you and Georgina? He cocks his head, confused. God, he's going to make me say it. Together. Aren't you two together? He laughs.
No, but we are close friends. And unlike Dora, her wife, I'm scared enough of her to let her drag me to see movies that bend the space-time continuum and feel several hours longer than they actually are.
Oh. Oh. During the interview, did she know about me? That I was the other candidate?
Not until a few minutes ago. I wasn't allowed to tell her who the other candidate was.
It's just... I scratch my neck, where heat is slowly creeping up. Earlier, when I introduced myself, she seemed to know who I was. He freezes, a millisecond of hesitation, then resumes with his casual, stone-strong confidence.
I did talk to her about you, but that was long before your interview. I told her that Greg was finally seeing someone, and that I was struggling.
Because you disapproved.
Elsie.
His tone is patient but firm.
I understand if you are uncomfortable with what I told you. But I've never lied to you, and I'm not going to start now.
His eyes hold mine like a vice.
I was attracted to someone I shouldn't have been attracted to. I felt guilty and frustrated, and I confided in George.
There's a frog in my throat. An entire ecosystem. 5 astral planes. Something glows and pulsates inside my stomach, and I don't know how to even begin to respond. Luckily, I don't have to, because Jack adds,
Greg wanted to meet with you this week. I asked him not to.
Why?
Because I had to tell him that you wouldn't get the job. He wasn't sure he wouldn't slip up, and I was planning to be the one who explained everything.
I feel myself smile. Not a good liar, is he?
I'm surprised he didn't blurt out about your arrangement on your first date.
Yeah, me too, actually. How is he?
Good, fine. The tooth healed. We talked about him. Honestly, he didn't insult me nearly as much as he should have.
Lucky for you, you found me. Your resident nut job, screaming abuse on the sidewalk.
Elsie.
He's doing that intense eye-holding thing again.
It's fine.
Nothing about this is fine, and it likely won't be for a long time. But I nod anyway and stand. Right. Sorry, again. Thank you for explaining everything, and for the hot chocolate. I should go home before the snow gets bad. He turns to one of the million windows.
Looks bad already.
It does. The outside's a whiteout of flurries, and my post-crying jag exhaustion is swallowing me whole. Maybe I can throw a smoke bomb and disappear into the quantum vacuum. Before it gets worse. He stands too.
I'll drive you.
What? No, the roads aren't safe. I'll just take an Uber. He lifts one eyebrow. With Cece, I add, checking my phone. No need to put you in danger if... I trail off and go through my texts. Cece. George assumes you're staying with Jack? Does she know something I don't? Uber surge pricing is insane. George offered to drive me home, but we need to leave now or the snow will strand the car. Please text me to reassure me that he's not making sausages out of your small intestine. I squeeze my eyes shut for a second. This is fine. It's okay.
You need a new phone,
Jack says quietly, glancing at the cracked screen. I need a new job. I'll take the bus, actually.
You think buses are running?
Hopefully. I attempt to smile. He's been nothing but kind, and he deserves a smiling, less than depressive Elsie. Unless you'd like me to camp out on your couch, I joke.
Nah, you can take the bed,
he says without pause, like he's been thinking this through. He can't have been.
You're not serious. I'll even change the sheets.
Why? He shrugs.
It's been a while.
I meant, why do you-
Because you're cold, Elsie.
He steps closer and I can feel the hot glow of his skin.
Because you had a rough night, and probably a rough month. Because it's not safe. And because I like having you around.
I should probably try to process this, but I am so, so tired. Do you have a spare room?
I do. No bed in it, though. And according to my friend Adam, my air mattress sucks ass.
Is that where you keep the skeletons of theorists? He smirks, doesn't deny it.
I'll take the couch. That's where I fall asleep reading theory articles every night anyway.
Maybe it's a jab, but it makes me laugh. I glance at the sectional, which could comfortably house three of them, and looks cozier than my childhood bed. I'm really not in the position to refuse this, though I make a last-ditch effort. I wouldn't want to put you out.
Elsie.
I hate it when he says my name like that. A little stern, amused, annoyed. Like I should be past my bullshit, even though I'm neck deep drowning in it. Okay. Thank you.
Do you need insulin? There's a pharmacy down the block.
Apparently, I now discuss my med supply with Jonathan Smith Turner. Wild. I just changed my pod. I'm good. He nods, and then, I guess it's happening. I'm staring at his back and following him up the L-shaped staircase, like the neutron star of helplessness I've been reduced to. I try to picture waking up tomorrow, squirting his toothpaste on my finger, making my way downstairs, nonchalantly complimenting his orthopedic pillow, then throwing out a laters before venturing out into the blinding white. I'm in the awkwardest timeline, but a proper freakout will have to wait until I have enough energy.
Bathroom's in here,
he says once we reach the upstairs landing. He rummages in a linen closet, then plugs a nightlight into the wall. For me. My heart squeezes.
That's my office.
He opens a door.
And here's the bedroom.
Jack has a headboard, unlike other more basic people, me, and a blue comforter, dark sheets that match the rug, and a bed that's probably a few notches above king. Emperor? Galactic dominator? No clue. But I bet he had it custom made. I bet the woodworker took a good look at Jack and said,
We'll need the wood of 1,000 here, Huon Pine, for a monstrosity like you. I shall head to Tasmania on my skiff at first light.
The rest of the room is tidy and uncluttered. No dirty boxers draped over the leather chair by the window. No Cliff Bar wrappers on the floor. The window takes up the entire east wall, and there's one single piece of art. A framed picture of the Large Hadron Collider. The end cap of the compact muon solenoid. A futuristic mechanical flower. It's beautiful. I know that Jack did some work at CERN, and maybe he took it himself.
I'll change the sheets,
he says, brushing past me toward the dresser, and I realize that I've been staring. Oh, don't. I'm not exactly picky, and I clear my throat. Whatever, it's fine. We can both sleep in here. I mean, the bed is huge. He's giving me his back, but I see the moment the words land. The drawer is half open, and his movements stutter to a stop. Muscles tense under his shirt, then slowly relax. When he turns around, it's with his usual uneven smile.
Seems like a lot for you,
he says. A bit strained, maybe. There's no dimple in sight. A lot?
Going from running away from me to sleeping in the same bed in under 1 hour.
I flush and look at my toes. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to run. And I'm not, like, coming on to you. I'd love to sound sharp and indignant, but it's just not where I'm at.
We've established that you don't need to come on to me, Elsie. Do you want something to sleep in?
Oh, I shake my head. I'm good. I'm wearing leggings anyway. I figured that if I had to suffer through 2001, I could at least be comfy.
I thought you loved the movie.
I give him an appalled look. Jack leans against the dresser, arms crossed.
It's what your friend said,
he explains. Oh, no. I mean, she thinks I do. She thinks I'm into artsy movies, but I don't really tell her the truth. I think Jack can read my mind.
Does she know how much you like Twilight?
He asks with a small, kind smile. No way. I laugh weakly. If anything, she might suspect I enjoy it ironically.
Ironically?
Yeah, you know, when you like something because it's bad and love making fun of it. He nods.
Is that why you enjoy Twilight?
I don't know. I sit on the edge of the mattress, gripping the soft comforter. I don't believe so, no. I ponder. It's like simple, straightforward romance stories with dramatic characters and improbably high stakes, I add, surprising myself a little. I didn't know this before putting it into words, and I feel like Jack has beaten me to some part of myself. Again. Also, I like to imagine Alice and Bella ending up together after the movie is over.
I see.
As ever, he files away. Then he pulls something that looks like sweats and a tee from under his pillow and heads for the door.
If you change your mind or get cold, just look around. You'll find something to wear.
Are you giving me permission to rummage around your bedroom? Like you have nothing to hide? He lifts one eyebrow.
What would I hide?
I don't know. I shrug. A giant tentacle dildo? Viagra? A diary with a pink locket? None of that would be worth hiding, he says. The most quietly confident man in the entire world.
I'll be downstairs if you need anything, okay?
The door closes with a soft click, and I'm right here. In Jack Smith Turner's bedroom, alone with his pillows and his CERN wall art and probably the desiccated livers of 12 theorists, plus a whole lot of falling snow. I quickly update Cece on the shit show that's my life and slide under the covers on what I hope isn't Jack's side, groaning in pleasure.
I have a really firm mattress, great for spinal health.
He sure does, and it's perfect. I immediately relax, enveloped by the comforter and a nice dark scent that I'm not ready to admit is Jack's. Oh, I could stay here forever, barricade myself, never face the consequences of my own failures. Cece replies, this is so weird, but good night. And I notice that my battery is at 12%. I glance around for a charger. Find none, then notice the nightstand. Jack gave me permission, right? So I open the drawer, bracing myself for, I don't know, cock rings, thumbs, a copy of Atlas Shrugged. But the inside is surprisingly mundane. Tissues, pens, keys, a flashlight with a few batteries, coins, and a white piece of paper that I cannot resist picking up. It's a photo, a Polaroid, blurry with a go board and a handful of people clustered around it. Only one face is fully in focus. A girl with brown hair and even features who frowns at the camera and me. It's me. The photo was taken at Millicent Smith's birthday party. A game ends in a draw. Izzy yells at people to smile. All the Smiths turn toward her, except for the tallest, who keeps looking at me, only at me, a faint smile on his lips. Oh, I say softly. To whom? I don't know. I lean back against the pillow, staring at the picture pinched between my fingers. Lights still on. Contemplating the fact that my furrowed brow resides in Jack's nightstand, I drift off in a handful of seconds and dream of nothing. When I wake up, the alarm clock says 3:46 a.m., and my first conscious thought is that I didn't get the job. I failed. It happened. I'm in the worst-case scenario. The scene of me finding out from George runs on a loop in my brain for several minutes, each replay spotlighting a different mortifying detail. I ran away in the middle of a conversation like a child. I left my closest friend alone in a snowstorm. I said terrible, unfair things. I don't make the decision to prowl downstairs, but once I'm there, I know it's where I need to be. The lamps are off and the snow is still falling, but enough light comes from the street to make out the contours of the place. Of Jack, who lies on his back on the sectional, a thin blanket draped over his lower half. His eyes are closed, but he's not asleep. Not sure how, but I know it. And he knows that I know it because when I step closer, he doesn't move, doesn't open his eyes, but he does ask,
do you need something?
His voice is scratchy, like he did sleep at some point. No, I lie, which of course he knows. He knows everything.
Want me to bring you up some water?
No, I'm awake, but not fully, because I kneel beside the couch, my head just inches from his, and ask, can I tell you something? His eyes finally open. He looks at me, and my hair is probably a mess. I am surely a mess, but I need to say this. What I said about George getting the job because she's your girlfriend, or friend, because of some weird political intrigue, it was unfair of me. Despicable. And I don't believe it. And I just, it was awful of me to,
Elsie. His tone is even and deep. Hey, it's okay. You already apologized.
He doesn't get it. I know, but of all the things that happened today, it seems like the shittiest. And I cannot control any of this. Not my career tanking, not whether I'm going to have health insurance or make rent, but I can control the way I react. So I'm sorry I said it. About George, and about you. And people do it to me all the time. In the last year of my PhD, I got this stupid award. When I walked into the student lounge the following day, other students were saying that it was only because I was a woman, and I felt like total shit. And I really didn't think they were right, but for a second, I wasn't sure. For a second, they made me doubt myself. And I don't want to be like them.
Hey,
Jack shifts and then does something I don't fully understand. Somehow he pulls me up. And somehow I'm on the couch, lying on the couch, next to him. My head nestles under his chin. His arms surround mine. Our thighs tangle together. I open my mouth to say something like, "What the hell?" or, "Oh my God!" or, "Huh?" But nothing comes out. Instead, I burrow deeper.
"Assholes,"
he says. I'm still asleep. This is a dream. A nightmare. A blend. Who?
The people who didn't like you winning the Forbes Award.
How does he know that's the award I was talking about?
You should report them.
For what? I ask against his throat. He's warm and smells nice. Like sleep. Like clean. Like he could easily change my sink, save kittens stuck in a tree, extinguish a fire. For being dicks?
Yes. Though HR would call it sexual discrimination and building a hostile work environment.
It's not that simple, I mumble.
It should be.
His chin brushes my hair every time he speaks, and I remember trying to mention what happened to Dr. L. The way he commiserated with me, but also said that it would be better if I just forgot it happened and focused my energies on physics. What would you do if your student said something like that?
I'd make sure they can never have a career in physics.
The words vibrate from his skin through mine, and I know he means it. I don't have a single doubt. And that's how I start crying again. Like a stupid Versailles fountain. And how his hold on me tightens, legs twisting further with mine. His fingers twine in the hair at my nape and press me deeper into him, shielding me from the cold and everything that's bad. I sniffle. I really wanted a chance to finish my molecular theory of two-dimensional liquid crystals.
I know.
His lips press against my hair. Maybe on purpose.
We'll figure out a way.
There is no we, I think. And Jack says,
"Not yet, no,"
with a small sigh that lifts his big chest.
"It'll be fine, Elsie. I promise."
He cannot. Promise, that is. There are no reliable sources, no known quantities. We're in a sea of measurement uncertainty. Maybe this rejection will be my supervillain origin story. He chuckles.
It won't.
How do you know?
because this is not your character arc, Elsie. More like a character bump.
I laugh wetly against his Adam's apple.
I need to go back upstairs. I've never slept with anyone, never even considered it. I can't control what I do at night. What if I move too much, or snore, or take up too much space?
A cover hog is the Elsie no one wants.
But with Jack, I have nothing to lose, right? We're past all that.
I can't believe I woke you up at 4 and you didn't murder me.
Why would I murder you?
Because it's late.
Nah, I'm kind of into it.
He yawns against the crown of my hair. You'll really enjoy the thrill of frequent nighttime urination as a senior citizen then.
It's not that.
I think he might be about to conk out.
This, it fits nicely in a bunch of really weird fantasies I have about you.
I remember the picture in his nightstand, his earnest face in Greg's apartment. I'm breathing the same air as Jack Smith, but I don't feel scared or unsafe. Just comforted, really. Warm and so sleepy.
Do these fantasies involve giant tentacle dildos?
I'm yawning too, fading fast.
Of course.
I can hear his wry smile.
Way more outlandish stuff, too.
Milkmaid role play?
Wilder.
It's furries, isn't it?
You wish.
You have to tell me or I'll
picture necrophilia and dismemberment.
In my weird fantasies, Elsie.
He shifts me till our curves and angles match up. Perfectly.
In my fantasies, you allow me to keep an eye on you.
I feel his lips at my temple.
And when I really let go, I imagine that you let me take care of you too.
It does sound outlandish. Why?
Because in my head, no one has done it before.
I fall asleep huddled in the curve of Jack's throat, wondering whether he might be right. 15. Heat transfer. There are no curtains, and I wake up first. The morning light is blinding white, as painful as a million naked mole rats gnawing at my eyeballs. Judging from the slow, rhythmic breath chuffing against the back of my neck, it's something Jack has gotten used to. I feel rested, warm, and cozy. At some point in the night, I must have turned around in his arms because my back is pressed against his chest. His hand is under my shirt, splayed flat against my belly, fingers brushing my pod, but not in a creepy sexual way. He's just trying to keep me close so that we both fit under the thin blanket. It should feel like being spooned by a piranha, but it somehow works. And maybe it is a bit sexual. Because there's something very hot, very, very hard, very, very, very big pressing against my ass. Jack probably needs to pee. Don't men get hard in the mornings when they need to go to the bathroom? It's a pee erection. A pee-rection. Yep. Still, I should leave. I try to slip out from under Jack's massive biceps, but he resists in his sleep. My heart races when he hums something into my nape, fingers gripping my hip. That hard thing pushes into me, trying to nestle farther between the cheeks of my ass, and I gasp.
You smell so good.
He growls into my skin, and all of a sudden I'm glowing with heat and embarrassment and something else, something new and pulsating and unfamiliar. I squirm around the feeling. Oh, God. Is this... Am I turned on? He's barely awake, and I bet he thinks I'm his pillow girlfriend, or whoever he slept with last, and I'm here all hot and...
Elsie.
He nearly grunts. His arm tightens around my waist, then abruptly relaxes. He's still fast asleep. And this time, when I wiggle away, he lets me go. I'm running upstairs, flushing cherry red, and he's once again breathing evenly.
It's okay. It's fine. Kinda creepy that I'm even thinking about this, since he's asleep.
In the bathroom, I brush my teeth. Yep, with my finger. Wash my face and reassure Cece that I haven't been sex trafficked. My inbox is bloated with emails. The highlight, from melaniesmom@gmail.com. Subject, Melanie. Melanie is a good person and did not mean to copy that essay from the internet. She told me so, and I believe her because I raised her, and in my household, we do not condone lies. She was framed. Her roommate has a vendetta against her ever since the menstrual cup incident. Please let my daughter resubmit her assignment. Melanie's mom.
I sigh twice,
then stress Snoop in Jack's cabinets. Finding some Rogaine or antifungal meds or prescription-strength deodorant would humanize him. But there's only toothpaste, wintergreen, disgusting, and soap. So I sit back on the edge of the tub and spend an unspecified length of time thinking of a way to let Dr. L know that I failed. I failed him. By the time I crawl downstairs, Jack's moving around the kitchen, phone lodged between shoulder and ear, laughing softly and saying,
"Since you're staying 3 days, we..."
He turns around. When he notices me standing at the bottom of the staircase, his smile fades. Yes, I'm still wearing the northeastern shirt I slept in. And yes, my hands are swallowed by my cardigan. And yes, I can't help stacking my feet on top of each other. Clearly, I'm bringing sexy back.
Need to go. See you next week.
Jack puts down his phone, then slides a mug of coffee across the kitchen island. For me, I assume. Which means that I have no choice but to make my way there and take a seat on a stool. He looks a bit disheveled, the back of his hair sticking up, stubble longer than last night, shoulders and arms filling the worn t-shirt. But he still has that air about him, amused, confident, unbothered. I wait for him to mention that we slept together. We slept together. But he doesn't seem to be inclined to be a dick about it.
Hey,
he says. The P-rection, trademark pending, is gone. I think. I can't really see. He probably used the bathroom downstairs and... Not the point, Elsie. Focus. Hey, I take a sip of my coffee. Disgusting, as coffee always is. I set down my mug, open my mouth to apologize again about last night, about the state of the world, about the cluster of atoms that shapes my very existence, when he says,
"Can I make you breakfast?"
Oh, I shake my head even as my stomach growls. I'm fine.
May I please watch you eat something?
Bam. Dimple.
It'll be good for my mental health.
Just take this day for what it is. Me marinating in a puddle of embarrassment. If you have a piece of toast, that'd be great. Thank you. He nods, slips a slice of whole grain in the toaster, and then asks a really odd question.
Why aren't you a full-time researcher?
I blink.
What? You got your PhD, then went straight to adjuncting. Most people try to squeeze in a full-time research position like a postdoc, especially if they're not passionate about teaching.
After years of hearing Dr. L talk about Jack, it's surreal having Jack bring up Dr. L, however obliquely. I did think of it, but there weren't any in the area. Theorists don't exactly swim in funding.
What about other places? You want to stay in the Boston area?
Yes. Well, I don't want to, but I should. For my family.
Are you close? Do they have health issues?
No, and no. Just my mom and my brothers are shit shows. Complete, utter shit shows. Like me. I can't leave. He nods. Like he doesn't fully understand.
Like he understands too much. You realize that your skill set would be of interest to more than theorists, right? Your work is highly translational. Experimental physicists would fight to have you on their teams.
They didn't, though. Dr. L asked around widely, and no one was fighting. No one was even politely arguing. Like who? He holds my eyes for a beat too long, and no, I shake my head. No. His mouth twitches.
I do have the funding.
No.
And the need.
Nope. He's fully smiling. Like I'm his personal entertainment center, amusing him in 4K and Dolby Surround.
We could negotiate salary.
No. Nope. No. I'm not going to work for you.
Why?
I'm not going to grade your tests and bring you coffee.
I have 3 TAs.
He looks pointedly at my full mug.
And I'm happy to take care of your coffee. You don't even like coffee, do you?
I squirm in the stool.
Oh, Elsie.
He shakes his head in mock disappointment and takes away the mug.
I thought you were above sparing my feelings.
You were really nice to me last night, and I clear my throat. Anyway, I can't work for you.
Why?
Because you are Jonathan Smith Turner and almost destroyed my entire field. And Dr. L would kill me. I don't add, but I still feel a stab of guilt for being about to literally break bread with my mentor's archenemy.
Okay.
He shrugs, setting a glass of water and toast in front of me.
Disappointing. But it does give me free rein to ask something else.
Ask what?
Can I take you out?
The words don't immediately compute. For several seconds, they float in my brain like driftwood, aimless, unparsable. And then their meaning dawns on me. You mean you want to murder me? He winces.
Once again, what happened to you?
You asked to take me out.
For a date.
Oh, I blush.
Oh,
I scratch the side of my nose. Jack's eyebrow lifts.
You seem more alarmed by dinner than murder.
No, yeah. I mean, it's just, why?
You know, I'm growing concerned about your language comprehension skills.
The corner of his mouth is quirking up, and I cannot take this anymore. Stop it, I order.
Stop what?
Being amused by me. I don't understand why you'd want to. We've done nothing but butt heads since the day we met. I cover my eyes with both hands. Why are you suddenly being so nice? Giving me shelter? Offering me a job? Is this some fetish of yours? Some people get off on armpit sex. You enjoy messing with me and.
Look at me, Elsie.
His voice snaps me to attention. Jack has moved around the island and is leaning against it, next to me. The back of his finger taps gently against my hand, grounding me. A silent,
shut up, will you? You done spiraling?
I'm not spiraling. I lie. Jack, believe me, you don't want to spend time with me. He nods, thoughtful.
What else don't I want?
I'm serious. For one, I'm technically still fake girlfriending your brother.
Didn't know it worked as a verb. Cute.
And you hate the personality switching thing.
That won't be a problem.
His eyes gleam.
Since I also enjoy calling you on your bullshit.
My cheeks heat. We have nothing in common. What would we even talk about?
We could spend 2 weeks just on liquid crystals. Or you could tell me about Twilight, your erotic Bill Nye fan fiction phase. Stream of consciousness would be fine, too. I'd love to know what you're thinking.
I think a lot about how much I hate you, I say with no conviction.
I think a lot about how much you hate me, too.
His smile is tender.
When's the last time you had someone in your life you could be completely honest with, Elsie?
Asked by anyone else, it would be a patronizing question. Because it's him, it just feels genuine. Maybe my parents when I was very young. But I can't remember a single moment in the past 2 decades in which I wasn't context dependent. In which I didn't feel the need to cut myself into pieces, serve the one I thought others would want on a silver platter. There have been easier people, like Cece. People who knew most parts of me, like Cece. Even people who recognized the pleaser in me and encouraged me to stop, like Cece. Okay, there has been Cece, and I'm grateful. But even with her, I've never been fully sincere. I've always been scared that honesty would be the deal breaker. It's been a while, I say. But Jack already knew that.
Then you're overdue.
This is terrifying. No, I say firmly, shaking my head. Thank you for the offer, but I'm not interested. Disappointment darkens his eyes, but I can barely take it in before a phone buzzes. His. Shit, he mutters. But he looks away and picks it up. And after a heaving sigh, he says,
I need to leave.
He grabs a sweater from the couch.
Let's go. I'll drop you off first.
I slide to my feet. I can take the bus. The storm's over, so...
Elsie.
Hand against my back, he pushes me to the entrance. No, seriously. You've already done so much. He takes a soft, cozy black hat and slides it over my head. It's not mine, but it feels great. And apparently I'm not awake enough to insist that I don't need a ride and button up my coat at the same time. It's fine. I can even take an Uber and... He notices my shaking hands and gently brushes them away to do my buttons himself.
Elsie, it's fine. I get it. You don't want me to take you out.
He gets to the highest button. His knuckles brush against my downturned chin.
At least let me take you home.
Jack's a confident driver. Relaxed even in bad weather conditions, with the roads not quite clear and other cars swaying. I sink into the heated seat he turned on for me and remember the time I swerved to avoid a squirrel, almost causing a multi-vehicle crash. The squirrel turned out to be a Wendy's paper bag, but it's fine. I'm good at other things. Probably. Feel free to pick up, I say, pointing at Jack's phone. It's been buzzing nonstop in the cup holder, a weird techno soundtrack to NPR's World News segment.
It's not a call,
he says, looking straight ahead. More buzzing. Are you sure?
Yeah, just an incessant barrage of texts.
Oh, it sounds urgent.
It isn't. Not by any sane definition of the word.
He sighs, uncharacteristically defeated.
Do you mind if I stop somewhere before taking you home? It's on the way and it'll take a minute.
No, it's fine, I say. Only to regret it when he pulls up a disturbingly familiar driveway. Isn't this? Jack kills the engine.
Regrettably, yes.
Should he be bringing me here, considering literally everything? Do you want me to, hide in the trunk or something?
It's 10 degrees. The car will get cold pretty fast.
So I should hide in the bushes? He looks at me like he's going to stage an intervention for my tenuous grasp of the second law of thermodynamics.
Come on. It'll be a minute.
Outside feels like Hoth, and my butt actively mourns the toasty warmth of the seat. It's considering a commemorative bench when the front door opens to the cruel, menacing, cutthroat glory of the most terrifying Smith, Millicent. Well, 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 she sings songs, standing cross-armed. She's wearing simple black pants and a cardigan. But even in a casual outfit, there's something intensely matriarchal about her. I cannot picture her ever having been anything but 90 and rich. Look who's not dead.
You know,
Jack says from my side in that ever amused tone of his,
I have many regrets in life.
I'm certain you do.
But teaching you how to text is the biggest.
Millicent waves her hand. When you were 3, I had to drive you to the ER because you stuck a purple crayon up your butthole. That should be your biggest regret.
Jack herds me inside the foyer with a gentle push on my lower back, like touching me casually is an established thing we have going on.
You took your sweet time, considering the money you could inherit when I croak.
Millicent holds her cheek up for Jack to kiss her. He refuses, instead enveloping her in a bear hug that she pretends to bristle at but clearly loves.
I told you, he says, just get buried with it.
I'm being cremated.
I hear paper burns great,
she scoffs. Keep on this way and I'll just will my entire fortune to Comcast.
She whirls around and marches down the glitzy hallway. Jack heads the same way, unperturbed, somehow managing not to look out of place despite being a mountain of muscles in a Caltech hoodie. After a moment of consideration, I decide to follow him. Better not be alone. Wouldn't want to be accused of stealing an ashtray. We step into the same kitchen where Jack caught me lying about the wine 2 weeks ago. I watch him walk to a cupboard, hold Millicent's eyes as he opens it, take out a bag of sugar, set it on the table, cross his arms, and ask,
Was this your life or death emergency?
Millicent beams.
Why, yes. I just could not reach it. And I so hate bitter coffee.
I glance at the cupboard, which is not high.
Glad I was able to come to your aid on this very urgent matter.
Jack nods politely, stops for a quick peck on his grandmother's cheek, then saunters to the door. His hand finds the usual spot on my back, and he gently pushes me out of the kitchen, clearly ready to leave, when...
But since you're already here, you should really stay for coffee.
Jack's arms drop to his sides, and he turns around.
Millicent,
he says, stern, amused. Must be a rich people thing, calling grandmas by their names.
Like I mentioned last week and the ones before, you don't need to trick me into spending time with you.
Oh, Jack, but I have been burned many times.
When was the last time you asked me to come over and I didn't?
3 years ago, on my birthday. It could have been my last.
But was it?
Hindsight schmeinsight.
She stares remotely into the distance.
I waited and waited for my one bearable grandchild to show up.
I lived across the country.
But alas, you'd left me, abandoned me, moved to the West Coast in search of something elusive. A Nobel Prize, perhaps?
I called you every day for 7 years.
How's that Nobel Prize coming along anyway?
He sighs.
You don't have to trick me,
he repeats. And this time she grins at him, impish and mischievous. And I remember that she has always been my favorite of Greg's relatives.
But it's more fun this way.
I suspect this is an interaction they've had multiple times. I suspect Jack is trying to not smile.
I'm taking Elsie home. Then I'll come back and...
Elsie?
Millicent turns, as though noticing me for the first time.
Elsie!
She takes a step toward me, and I stop breathing, trying to make myself inconspicuous. Who needs oxygen? I'll just photosynthesize from now on.
Why is Elsie so familiar? I gulp, comically.
Ah, yes. You beat Jack at Go.
We tied, actually. I glance at Jack, who's smiling, like my discomfort puts him in a good mood.
Indeed.
Millicent's eyes laser focus on me, and I wonder what I should say if she asks why I'm here. What's the cover story?
You don't look too good.
She had a rough night, Jack says mildly.
Let her be.
Millicent nods knowingly.
Dear, whenever they can't get it up, they sit on the edge of the mattress with their heads between their hands and whine like babies and turn it into our problem. But
I gasp. No, that's not what we...
She just found out she didn't get a job,
Jack explains, unruffled.
But thank you for the vote of confidence.
If you say so.
Millicent seems unconvinced. Then her eyes light up with a glimmer of recollection.
Wait! She's not yours, is she? She's the girlfriend of the one who always looks like he just stress ate a crabapple over a trash can.
Jack rolls his eyes.
You mean Greg, my brother? Your grandson?
How would I know? I have 4 children and 7 grandchildren. How many names do you expect me to memorize?
11 would be a good start.
Bah!
Her eyes fix on me, sharp.
She is his, though.
Not really,
Jack says.
It's a long story.
Perfect! You can tell me over coffee. 2 sugars as always, Jack?
Yep.
He turns to leave again.
I'll have it when I come back from taking Elsie.
Nonsense. Elsie must stay too. I simply cannot let her leave.
Yes, you can, because kidnapping is a serious felony offense.
Psh!
I'm driving her home and...
It's fine, I interrupt. They both look at me, stunned by my capacity for speech. I don't mind staying.
See? She doesn't mind.
Millicent claps her hands and drops any pretense of helplessness, pulling 3 mugs from a cupboard that's much higher than the one with the sugar. Jack hesitates, though. He takes a step closer and scans my face for traces of my little untruths. Really, I say, only for Jack's ears. It's fine.
Fine? Spending unremunerated time with 2 Smiths?
Staying perfectly suits my yellow brick quest for the lesser evil, because it allows me to postpone informing Dr. L of what happened, or even dealing with the consequences of it. As long as I'm here, time is suspended. The past is set, and I didn't get the job. Any future, however, is possible. AOC will rise to power to forgive my student loans. My pancreas will produce its own insulin. I'll retire to the countryside, live off the land, and spend my days thinking about the kinematics of crystal-rich systems.